I've given it a little bit of thought what to talk about tonight. And a theme, or maybe a word, which was coming up for me was the theme of the world. And also, if I say the world, then this can have many meanings. And you know what is triggered off in your mind when you hear this words, just this word, the world. And also in the Buddhist teachings, it has many connotations. There are certain presentations and discourses devoted to this theme. And the Buddha himself, he called himself, both ways actually, he was called, and he's calling himself a Lokavitu, a knower of the world. And I think if we use the term the world in that way, we have to enlarge it quite a bit beyond the normal scope. We could maybe even say the world, we could use the plural, worlds, the cosmos. So the Buddha was, of course, with his particularly special knowledge and insight he had, he could with full confidence claim to be a knower of the world. He knew the world inside out. But first of all, starting with his own experience, starting as a very ordinary practitioner, just as all of us, as we are starting, you know, wherever we are, we're starting to practice, you know, within the environment we find ourselves in, and we try our best. We give us our best shot so that we can see if we can actually come to know the world ourselves. And of course, when I speak like that, I don't talk about the external world, let alone the world news and, you know, the more the superficial side of the world, but more the inner world, our very personal world. And also the Buddha himself, that was his main practice ground, his main area of exploration was his own inner world. This is where his profound wisdom and profound insight arose. It was not an externalized knowledge. It was not a borrowed knowledge from someone else. The Buddha didn't read books. He didn't have books in those days. But he read the books of his own heart, as our teacher Lumpo Cha used to say. Put the books away. If you really want to gain understanding and insight, put the books away, at least for the time being, when it comes to practice, to develop one's own individual understanding of oneself, one's own reality, and don't lean too much on anyone else. Yes, of course, admittedly, it is certainly all right to also take in external sources for inspiration, to keep us on track, to maybe give us a little bit of an extra shot when our energies are waning, or when you get a little bit disillusioned with ourselves or with the world, however. But at the end of the day, it is up to us. We have to make the effort. We need to put ourselves to the task. If we don't do anything, then we cannot expect anything. So, and I thought today, as I've mentioned the Buddha already a few times, and it has a reason, I've actually brought a little passage from one of the suttas, which I thought was very suitable to bring and introduce to you. Maybe you have heard this before. It's not a very long one. And also some of the repetitions, I shortened them a little bit so that you don't get into a sleepy trance state when you're listening to this. So this discourse is called the Rohitasa Sutta. It's from the Samyutta Nikaya. And it's about the a visitor which the Buddha had. The Buddha was living at the time in Jetta Grove up in Sawati, in northern, today, which is today northern India, bordering Nepal. And that late at night a certain visitor presented himself to the Buddha. And so it says on this little discourse. On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying near Savati in Jeta Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. Then Rohitasa, the son of a deva, in the far extreme of the night, his extreme radiance lighting up the entirety of Jeta's Grove, went to the Blessed One. On arrival, having bowed down to the Blessed One, he stood to one side. As he was standing there, he said to the Blessed One, "Is it possible, Lord, by traveling, to know or see or reach a far end of the cosmos or the world, where one does not take birth, age, die, pass away, or reappear?" And then the Buddha replies, "I tell you, friend, that it is not possible by traveling to know or see or reach a far end of the cosmos or the world, where one does not take birth, age, die, pass away, or reappear." Then the Devata again, "It is amazing, Lord, and awesome, how well that has been said by the Blessed One. Once, in a previous time, I was a seer named Rohitasa, a student of Bhoja, a powerful skywalker. My speed was as fast as that of a strong archer, well-trained, a practiced hand, a practiced sharpshooter, shooting a light arrow across the shadow of a palm tree. My stride stretched as far as the East Sea is from the West. To me, endowed with such speed, such a stride, there came the desire, I will go traveling to the end of the cosmos or the world. I, with a 100-year life, 100-year span, spend 100 years traveling, apart from the time spent on eating, drinking, chewing and tasting, urinating and defecating, and sleeping to fight off weariness. But without reaching the end of the cosmos, I died along the way. So it is amazing, Lord, and awesome, how well that has been said by the Blessed One." Then he calls the Blessed One, "I tell you, friend, that it is not possible by traveling to know or see or reach a far end of the cosmos, where one does not take birth, age, die, pass away, or reappear. But at that time, I tell you that there is no making an end of suffering and stress without reaching the end of the cosmos. That this is just within this fathom-long body, within its perception and intellect, that I declare that there is the cosmos or the world, the origination of the world or the cosmos, the cessation of it, and the path of practice leading to the cessation of the cosmos. It is not to be reached by traveling the end of the cosmos regardless, and it's not without reaching the end of the cosmos that there is release from suffering and stress. So truly, the wise one, an expert with regard to the cosmos or the world, a knower of the end of the cosmos or the world, having fulfilled the holy life, calmed, knowing the cosmos end or the world's end, doesn't long for this cosmos or for this world or for any other." So this is, of course, admittedly, a tall order of things when we hear the Buddha speaking like that, that and especially mentioning at the end what is called the holy life, someone who has fulfilled the holy life. Of course, he's referring to monks and nuns, so people are living the holy life, who have been calmed and who have been through their own insight, come to know the world or the worlds or the cosmos, as it's very often translated here by Ajahn Chah Nisro in this in his translation. And so what do we do with that as ordinary mortals sitting here in the shrine room or on your couches when you hear this? Do you dare to think that far, that you, as you're there, can reach the end of this world or the worlds or the cosmos? Is this actually a possibility, a realistic possibility? Do you even take it into the scope of possibilities for yourself? Or do you, when you maybe hear these words, think, oh, this is only for the few, you know, the chosen few, the experts or the professionals and so forth? But I think when we hear these discourses, we shouldn't get intimidated by the language or the pointing maybe towards the monastic order or so, but we should really see, well, what is in there for us? You know, what is our world? How do we investigate our personal world? Because it says in this text, you know, within this fathom-long body, fathom-long is a quite an old-fashioned expression. I guess you know what is meant by it. Within this very body, as it's sitting here, all of us, each and every one of us, can realize the truth through knowing our world. Coming to the end of this word, as it's saying in this presentation, means, of course, you could equal it with the coming to the end of dukkha, of suffering, of stress, any sense of discontent, ill at ease, or anything which we might, in the vaguest sense, connect with something which causes a sense of pressure or stress in ourselves. And again, also that can appear to be something which one might, you know, put far away or far ahead of oneself, or maybe not in this life. Maybe I have to go in a similar way like this deva here, this angel, you know, go through a manifestation in the deva realm before I can actually seriously consider this. But I'd like to encourage you to take this up, take the exploration of your inner world up and ask yourself, well, how does this world manifest? It manifests not only through this body, the fathom-long body, as it's mentioned, but it mentions in the realm of feelings and emotions we're experiencing. It manifests through the intellect, the mental fabrications, the associations, the value judgments, the biases and opinions and views we have about things. And of course, it also manifests through the way how we relate to the sense world, the relationship we have with the sense world, through the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and again, then through the mind. This is our world. This is how it manifests for us personally. And I think it's very good to have it very nicely and concisely grouped together like this so that we don't get lost in doubts and worries about, well, what is this world? What is my world? Well, it's right here. Whatever manifests itself at any given moment in time, this is a manifestation of your world, of your personal world. And we have to be, I would say, we have to be honest what this personal world not only looks like, but what it is influenced by. Are we very clear about what is manifesting and arising at any given moment in our personal world? Or are very often slightly besides our shoes, slightly off guard, always a little bit behind and always noticing afterwards what has been going on in our citta, in our consciousness, after we have been prey to our automatic reactions. And the automatic emotional reactions, the mental reactions which we have when we relate to the outer world, external world, but also to ourselves, that is something really to pay attention to, because that's where those energies, or for lack of a better word, I say energies, or those impulses manifest, which lead us into cul-de-sacs, which lead us into tightness, narrow-mindedness, and a very strong identification of self, what the Buddha calls which is the me-making and the mind-making process. And this me-making, mind-making process goes on all the time, uninterruptedly. and it has very gross forms, very gross expressions, you know, when we kind of assert ourselves maybe against some people in our work sphere or in a family environment or wherever, where we, you know, take in a very strong position and very obvious manifestation or a very strong manifestation of self. But very often, most of the time, in the course of the day, it happens in more subtle ways. These subtle waves of feeling and emotion and evaluation and reaction and taking possession of these impressions and so forth. Usually this happens completely out of sight, out of conscious sight. And it's because of that, because it happens in many, many times in such a subtle way, that we're encouraged to develop the quality of awareness, of mindfulness. We can really attend to these minute movements in the citta, in the heart, in the mind, and be conscious of them. Or if we can't be conscious of it all the time, to at least move in the direction of becoming more conscious of it, reminding ourselves whenever we lose the plot, whenever we find ourselves in a whirlpool of dissatisfaction, of discontent, of grumpiness, of frustration, of anger, and so forth. Whenever, especially negative emotions come on the screen, so to speak, that is a very strong indicator for us not to judge ourselves for it, but to say, stop, what is this? Really be with it, be willing to be with the strong manifestations of the ego self. The ego self has, if it's unguarded, has a lot of power. It can take us into many, many journeys, many, many directions in the inner world, but also in the outer world, especially, of course, if we're completely under the control of the ego self, if we have no awareness whatsoever, if there's no conscious acknowledgement of what is happening within our inner world, then we will also manifest in the outer world as a very heedless person. And we usually, when we do that, we also get the feedback. We will bounce off other people's egos. And what we can see very often when people are very, especially say in the realm of having opinions and views. Nowadays, as we can witness in this intensified general environment we are at the moment, in this time of the pandemic, we can see that many people have all sorts of opinions about this, about the pandemic and about what to do about it, what should be done, what the politicians should do, what they shouldn't do, and so forth, what maybe one's family members should do, what the people in the work sphere should do, and so forth. And if this is not, if we're not careful with this, we can very easily get locked into a fixed position, taking a very fixed view, or even worse, then we're moving into complaining and whining and complaining, taking a very immature attitude of being a complainer towards those people out there. Somebody has to be responsible for this mess we're in right now. This is very immature, isn't it, if I speak like that? But we can hear this, huh? We just have to open a news page and so forth, and there it is, the whining and complaining, the pointing the finger, trying to find somebody responsible. And the, as we all know, the voices of our, the ego self, are very often very immature. Sometimes they manifest, one has the impression, I mean, I'm partly talking about myself. If I acknowledge the most impure parts of myself, I can hear a six-year-old talking with temper tantrums, and, you know, very, being very insistent and very stubborn, very unwilling to give in, just insisting, I'm right and you're wrong. And this, of course, very often also we seem to be find it easier to see it out there, huh, with the other person and other people. We can see what they're doing. Well, they're obviously stuck in attachment to their opinion and to their views. I'm not. I don't have any views. Can you be without any views? Can you be without any opinions? Is that possible? I don't think so. I have to admit, I have views all the time, and opinions too. But I think, it's not too bold to say that tonight, that over the years I've learned how to hold views and opinions. And I catch myself quicker when I feel a tightening in the chest or further down below in the abdominal area, when there are the clear somatic signs, oh, now I'm insisting that my view, my opinion is the right one, and this other one is the wrong one. But this is, again, just a manifestation of the ego self, the tightened expression of the personality. And this is usually a sign of watch out now. If you really buy into that, if you really let yourself be invited on a trip, on a ride, then you'll be in trouble. If you don't get the external feedback, you will eventually get the feedback from within yourself, provided that there is some form of awareness and mindfulness already in operation, and then we will catch ourselves sooner or later. I see. I got lost there. How did this happen? I didn't even notice. Suddenly I found myself in this argument and this heated debate, and I didn't even know how this started. Again, then we acknowledge that there's no need to call ourselves bad names for it, but to acknowledge, okay, this is always happening when we're unguarded, when we're not conscious or aware what is happening at any given moment. And so this giving attention to the inner world, to our world as it manifests, is of utmost importance. And not only simply to stay with that, you know, and rest there and be, say, settle for that, but this is the way to awakening. This is one of the roads to awakening. We have to choose one road, don't we? One of the many avenues and roads to awakening are certainly for us to be walked upon. And there's no need to wait for the ideal road or for the avenue broad enough or the one suiting me, but always the one which we are with, which we're with right now. That's why in the teachings that we have, we always pointed to the immediacy of the attending to our world, the immediacy of the here and now, because it's the only time and the only place where we can know the inner world. If we're basing our investigation on our memory, what was yesterday, what was last year, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, then it's not so reliable. After all, it's only a memory, and that even changes. I've noticed, I don't know about you, but I've noticed the memories of certain incidents 20 years ago, even last week or last month, they keep changing. They're not really reliable. And so they're not too much learning potential in that, if I'm speaking from a spiritual perspective. From a spiritual or a dhammic perspective, it is always the immediacy, the dhamma here and now. That's very often, this is emphasized in the Buddhist teaching. That's where the truth can be realized. Our truth, our personal truth, the truth of our world. And then this personal truth is not a truth to be identified with. It's just the opposite. It's the truth where we're loosening the identification with it. We're not anymore grasping the five groups of identity. You know, we're not anymore grasping the body, the feelings, the perceptions and memories, the mental fabrications and the sense consciousness. But we're letting things be as they are, as they function, without interfering through the grasping tendencies. And when we finish and say no to the grasping tendencies, or maybe that sounds for some of you like it's an act of will, which we have to do repeatedly. But I would suggest it's more based on the investigation. Huh? How do these tendencies of grasping, of attachment, and so forth, of becoming and getting born into a new state of consciousness based on the strategies of grasping, how does this come about? How am I producing these results, which actually I don't want? I don't want results based on egoic identity. What I aspire to from a deepest level in my heart is a freedom which can only be based on non-grasping, non-clinging, on non-attachment. And so for that to become into clearer rule, we have to look at, you know, how does this come about? How do feelings affect us when we experience, you know, pleasant, unpleasant feelings in our lives? Likewise, emotions and so forth. What do they do with us? How do they move us? In what direction do they want to, shift us? If we can be present without moving into reactive mode towards our feeling states, emotional states, and the fabrications of our thinking, then it's quite likely that the grasping tendencies, the clinging, will not set on. It will not come about. Or if it does, it will come about maybe under the view of our own observation. We see, we understand the process. Aha, if I blindly follow this, and then this is the result. I will cling, I will become and move into some other state of consciousness. And usually at the end of that, there's some form of discontent, at the very least, dissatisfactoriness and pain. So that whole cycle is something really worthy to investigate. And actually, as I'm talking about this, I have another little piece I want to bring to your attention, which actually speaks about this particular theme. There's a particular theme. This is presented in the Loka Sutta. The Loka is actually the Pali word for world. So that's, the sutta is called the world. And this is again taking place in Savatthi. And so in Savatthi, this time there's not a heavenly being involved, but the Buddha is speaking to his monks. Dwelling at Savatthi, the Blessed One addressed the monks. I will teach you the origination of the world and the ending of the world. So listen and pay close attention. I will speak. As you say, Lord, the monks responded to the Blessed One. And then the Blessed One said, what is the origination of the world? Dependent on the eye and forms, there arises eye consciousness. The meeting of the three is contact. From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging. From clinging as a requisite condition comes becoming. From becoming as a requisite condition, or simply one could also say becoming simply conditions birth. From birth as a requisite condition comes then aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair. This comes into play. This is the origination of the world. So some of you, this might sound a little bit familiar. This is the formula of dependent origination, one of the very central teachings of the Buddha, apparently, that the realization of this teaching on dependent origination came to the Buddha in the night of his awakening. And then the Buddha continues, of course, he goes through the other areas of the senses, through ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and so forth, and mental consciousness. And again says, there, this is the origination of the world. And then he turns the whole thing around and says, so what is the ending of the world? Depending on the eye and forms, there arises eye consciousness. The meeting of the three is contact. From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. Now from the remainderless cessation and fading away of that very craving comes a cessation of clinging. From the cessation of clinging comes a cessation of becoming. From the cessation of becoming comes a cessation of birth. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair. All this ceases. Such is the cessation of this entire mass and stress, of stress and suffering. This is the ending of the world. So, and again, the Buddha also uses the other forms of consciousness relating to the other senses and presents here what is really meant now in the Dhammic sense, the ending of the world. And of course, this is a very formalized way of presenting it. Maybe for some of you, I don't know, we can talk a little bit about it. It might sound a little bit too abstract, but we can also, you know, put it very simple. When we give up, when we learn to let go and learn to detect those moments when we would normally incline towards craving and clinging, you know, these kind of mechanisms inwardly, we do this, then when we detect that, that can be the first step of freeing us from this very strategy. The strategy of clinging can do its first steps to coming to an end. And this needs to be something we continuously encourage ourselves with, rather than maybe having a kind of idealized view of ourselves, how we'd like to be. Yes, this sounds all very nice in theory and so forth, but is this really up to me? Well, we can only find out if we try, you know? And I think most of you probably have experienced a fair share of this was mentioned in this discourse of the clinging and the becoming and then the resultant forms of stress and anguish and despair and so forth. And we've turned in circles. We haven't really found quite a way out of it. But then, as I can see also, there's a lot of old hands present now this evening. Many of you have also have experiences of insight and understanding when these gestures have moved around and we've made this gesture, we've opened our hands, we've given ourselves towards the strategy of letting go. And we can always, the easiest way when to move into strategy is, of course, when we have a sense of tightness in our citta, in our heart, or we experience some kind of negative feeling or emotion, then let's hold it first. We're not trying to push. The letting go is not based on the desire of the ego. It's not based on the forces of will or willpower, but it's based on the clear seeing, clear understanding, this is what's happening. I've gotten really fixated on this opinion. I've gotten really into an anger vortex or a fear vortex or into a righteous indignation, you know. So it's a lot of righteous indignation around nowadays. How dare they do that, these people at the top of the ladder, and so forth. So I assume that you're probably, all of you listening tonight, you're not probably belonging to that part of the society, maybe occasional impulse. We have our moments, all of us, haven't we? But overall, we have a higher aspiration. We'd like to free ourselves from the tendencies of identification with the ego self, the tightness of what the ego self wants us to do, what it demands. And when we're coming into more and more into the modus operandum of awareness and mindfulness, then we have much better cards to free ourselves from all forms of clinging and attachment. And that is And that is the road to freedom. That's the road to liberation. One step at a time, isn't it? Two step at a time, difficult. And we're also not quite so talented as this Skywalker, which was mentioned in the first thing I wrote out to you, Roy Tassa, when he was in his previous birth, he seemed to have psychic powers and he could walk, with huge steps and still didn't reach the end of the world, the manifest world, of course. And he was talking about. And we don't even try that yet. We don't want to try to get to the end of the manifest world of the cosmos, the manifest cosmos. But we turn towards the inner cosmos. This is where truth lies, where reality lies, where we can go beyond the world, which means we're not identified any longer with the demands the world, in brackets, is putting on us. So I think I'll stop there so we have at least a little bit of time for any comments or questions, if you have some.
Thank you, Ajahn, very much for the talk. Could you please quote where in the Samyutta Nikaya I can find the Rohitasa Sutta and the Loka Sutta? Thank you.
Where? I can tell you exactly.
Thank you.
But these are, of course, the English numbers, and they're different from the Germans. You have to kind of find out. You can check that probably on the internet. So Loka Sutta is Samyutta Nikaya 1244. And the Rohitasa Sutta is Samyutta Nikaya 226. It also appears in another section, the Rohitasa, in the Anguttara Nikaya 938. So that was an easy question. Anything else besides sources, scriptural sources, scriptural references?
So I take my chance. I was touched by the gesture you made, because it was very familiar to me, this grasping. And it really got into my heart. And I wanted to ask, do you use this in your daily practice, like this body gestures to do?
I do a lot of body contemplation, but I don't sit on my cushion doing this. But it's more reference to the tightening, because that's a very tight gesture. If I have my hands like this, and you might have seen in the Tibetan iconography, the wheel of life, it's actually, a monkey grasping a fruit, making also this gesture, grasping after a fruit. And so, but for me, it's more the kind of, is to be seen in a transfigured sense. It's more a tightening, which I can feel and sense in the body. Whenever I sense something, also, when you do a lot of mindfulness of breathing, and then you can stay easily in touch with tightenings in the somatic system. And then you can go there with your attention and stay there and be with it. That's actually a very nice way of getting into the stream, so to speak, of letting go. First, you're allowing yourself to feel this knot in your abdomen, or the tightness in your chest, or the rumbling in your belly, or whatever it is. And usually connected with some kind of little emotional melodrama, maybe. But rather than becoming mental and evaluating it and commenting it or calling yourself bad names for having negative feelings, you just simply allow yourself to be with it. And then you can make the experience for yourself. What are the conditions for this to move on? We're not even waiting for it. you give it your attention unconditionally. That's another subtle point that very often people using, say, mindfulness practice or awareness practice, and they tend to something within themselves and then they're waiting for it to go. And this is not even conscious, this waiting strategy, but so I'm, you know, saying in a way, I'm so mindful now, so it should shift now. I want to get rid of this unpleasant feeling. So again, the demands of the ego can come in there, which of course would like to have something pleasant and want to get rid of the unpleasant as quick as possible. And so that's why this unconditional attitude and unconditional attitude is important. We give it all the time in the world. This is there now. I don't even have to ask why. I just connect with it on the felt sense level. And then you can see that the grasping, not only the tight grasping in the somatic realm, but also the mental grasping, even wanting to understand it. Where does it come from? What is it? Why am I in this anger syndrome now? You know, we very often go into this why mode and in the doubt, self-doubting mode, etc. So then you can release that. But it's the release happens based on the quality of the attention you give it. That's very important. It's an unconditioned, both probably is right, way of attention. I give it all the time in the world, whatever it wants, you know. And then we'll see when the release comes, the letting go comes. And then it's not based on the manipulation of the ego self. And it's a natural letting go based on understanding. Yeah, is that clear?
Thank you very much, Bhante.
Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Okay. Susanna, something to say?
Just to the last words that you mentioned, it's I think it's really hard sometimes to find the difference between wanting to understand, which is coming more from an ego territory, or really waiting for the understanding that comes through. So is there any experience? I mean, it's time, it's waiting, it's cultivating an unconditional presence.
Yeah, waiting.
But how do you work when you feel the grasping of, oh, I want to understand, so kind of an orientation need?
Well, wanting to understand is impatience.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Wanting to understand is impatience. So that also, of course, very often we get impatient, isn't it, with ourselves, especially when things keep recurring and repeating themselves, and we've witnessed it so many times, we've been attending it so many times, and still comes. It means that, simply means that our in understanding, or maybe our penetration also, is not deep enough. And when I say penetration, I don't mean a penetration like an act of will, really go in there with your willpower, but penetration in a sense of understanding deeply. And this comes more through allow things to be as they are, is a very good motto to start off with. Everything, allowing everything to be as it is. It could be a very good motto for all of us, really, in our life. I'm not even saying spiritual life or Dhamma life, say life in general. Because so often we are in immediate resistance against that which has already presented itself. And we don't notice that we are in resistance. That's why sometimes, and come back to your comment, it takes a lot of patience, you know, with ourselves. And getting out of the waiting mode. Waiting mode can also be very often, of course, in a subtle way, be an expression of impatience. We're saying basically, I don't want this really any longer. Or when does this shift? I've been attending it so diligently for so long and it's still bothering me. If it's still bothering you, if it's still there and on your screen, so to speak, then you haven't given it, you haven't allowed it quite that kind of fully wise and attentive space which it needs, you know, to be released out of your consciousness. So be a little bit more patient. Patience is a very important virtue, not only in the spiritual life now in this very personal sense, but as we can see nowadays with the situation we're in with the special pandemic we're having, there's an enormous amount of impatience now. People can't bear another moment of it. They want this to end. But then it's not up to us. Outside and also inside. And outside, of course, we don't have so much influence about what goes on outside, you know, what is actually going to change, say, some major challenge for our society at large. Most of it is beyond us. But the attitude we have towards this, for example, you know, that is important. We can take responsibility for that. And we can learn a lot from that, you know. Makes sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I'm a bit hanging with, I was experimenting more with the metta praxis. And I feel a bit like patient is good to come together with kind of a unconditioned presence, which has an aspect of what we call love, or if you're just patient, it's a bit kind of dry.
When you're in that impatient, loving space, then you're not impatient, isn't it? When you love, you're not impatient. No.
So that gives a bit of the color of...
I'm loving you very impatiently. You never say that to anybody. Or to any situation, you know.
Yeah.
Of this situation totally impatiently. It sounds ridiculous. But yes, it's true what you said, you know. That is a very good ingredient, additive. So, if you're not, let's just sit quietly for a few moments. As we are connected via this strange medium, let's just close with a few moments of silence. Let forget about all the concepts and words. Maybe some of it was even unknown. Don't worry too much about it and just... turn inward, turn towards the silence within yourself, which is always available, believe it or not. The silence is always there. Quietness, once we care to turn towards it. Turn away from the activities of the mind, the objects of the mind. With the mind, I also mean the affective side and the cognitive side, both, of course, the heart and the mind. Just abiding in the silence.